Welcome back to Drafting the Past, a podcast all about writing history. I'm your host, Kate Carpenter, and on this episode, I was so excited to get to talk with Dr. Margaret O'Meara.
I'm really pleased to be here. Thanks, Kate.
Margaret is a professor of modern American history at the University of Washington, and she is the author of multiple books, including Cities of Knowledge, Cold War Science, and the Search for the Next Silicon Valley, and Pivotal Tuesdays, Four Elections That Shaped the 20th Century. Her most recent book is The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. I was a huge fan of this book, and I recommended it to so many people, so I was thrilled to get to ask about what went into writing it. Margaret has also co-authored a history textbook, written pieces for places including the New York Times, Wired, many more, and is an active public speaker. We talked about how she keeps track of so many different projects, the way her past work in the Clinton administration affects her writing, and much more. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Margaret O'Meara, and I know you will too.
Like a lot of writers and a lot of historians, I started off as a bookworm, a reader, reading everything I could get my hands on. I kind of fell in love with understood how to have my own voice as a writer, I think, in high school English classes with English teachers that helped me figure out how to put words on the page and make a case. And then I trotted off to college initially as an English major. And then I added on history once I got there because I realized how close that one could read and write a lot as a historian, too. But I really think that the roots of how I write now, funnily enough, come from my first job out of college, which was I graduated and I went to work on a presidential campaign on the 1992 campaign of Bill Clinton, and then worked in that administration for the first term and a little bit. And in the course of that work, my job involved a lot of writing, but not writing, not perhaps very exciting writing, but it was very good discipline. I wrote briefing book for cabinet secretaries and for a while for the vice president. And so every day, the people who are at the top of the government get a big binder of here are all the things you're doing. And there's a cover memo that's kind of summarizes the key things. And in some cases, they're in events where they might not have a speech, but they have talking points. So you had to have some bullet points. And that introduced me to the importance of the rule of three, right? Three things. And keep it short and keep it succinct and get to the point and don't have throat clearing or unnecessary words. And I think that structure really has been a guidance for me throughout my career as a historian.
Yeah, you can definitely see that come through in your writing. I wondered if that job had had an impact.
Yeah.
Let's just start with the basics. So when and where do you like to do your writing?
I can write anywhere. My most important element of any writing discipline is a deadline. So if need be, I can make it happen. But I am I like to be in spaces with other people when I write. It actually helps my focus. I've long been a coffee shop writer. Fortunately, I live in Seattle where there are lots of them and other people doing the same thing. But there is something about the ambient noise and the presence of others and somehow it's the eyes on the street people, you know, no one really cares what I'm doing, but I feel like I need to, you know, look like I'm concentrating, and that in turn makes me concentrate on what I'm doing. There's something about taking oneself out of the usual space and being in another space solely to write that I find helpful.
Do you have a routine?
I am usually rather than blocking my day, more often than not, I have days when I write and days when I do other things. I tend to be someone who kind of sits down and goes in on a big, you know, multi-hour. I just need to focus on one thing at a time. And I've experimented with other things. I think that one of the things that historians do, I think this is one reason your podcast is so interesting and so useful to so many of us, is that it's very interesting to see how other people do it and to play around with whether that would be a more effective way and a happier way for one to get one's own writing done. But generally speaking, I found that blocking off my work weeks into a teaching day and a writing day, or having periods of time. Right now, I'm on sabbatical, so this is very much I'm in research mode and writing mode. There's challenges to that though too, because you have control over your time, but you have control over your time. So you're entirely responsible for creating the containers into which you put your work and get things done, which can be a challenge.
How do you like to organize yourself, your research and your writing? Are there tools that you use?
Yes, I am. I use a number of tools, mostly digital, but some analog too. I've been a longtime user of Zotero. I've been using it since almost the very beginning, and it now has a very voluminous library that I periodically go in and try to, you know, be a little more organized about. But particularly because so much of what I do is modern history, and particularly when I'm writing about the tech industry, there are a lot of things that exist on the internet, either live on the internet or archived in the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine. So having that browser add-on where I can just click and immediately save a web page to Zotero is extraordinarily useful. So that's just really my kind of, that's the big container into which everything goes. And of course, you have to organize from there. I tend to use, I've tried to use some different tools like Scrivener, which so many writers I admire use with enthusiasm. I'm a Word person, and I think this is just, I'm a Gen Xer and I've always used it. And even Google Docs, I get a little frustrated with when I'm collaborating with graduate students or scholars who are of a Google Doc generation. I will gamely try to go along, but I generally am a Word Doc person and I enjoy that. And so I will use Word Docs as a place to be containers, subject specific containers for notes on something, particularly if I'm writing something shorter like an op-ed or even working on an essay or a journal article. I will kind of have subject-specific Word docs that try to consolidate notes from Zotero and relevant quotes and kind of put them in one place where I can look at it all at once and see how those things relate to one another. So then I have yellow pads and I write things down on yellow legal pads, and I have lots of those and lots of pieces of paper strewn around my house and in my office. My family gently tolerates them, but that just oftentimes writing things down on paper. And certainly when I'm listening to something, whether it be a lecture or a recording of something, I sit and I write down notes. I take notes on paper, and somehow that really helps my attention and my retention.
Do you keep both your primary and secondary sources then in Zotero?
I do. And there's in part because I think this is also a reflection of, yeah, the kind of where I'm getting a lot of things. And certainly when writing the code, I was working with archives, but I was also building my own archive of a sort. I was working with with subjects that many of which weren't that interested in archiving their materials. So I had to be creative. But yes, I keep them all, and I try to organize them by subject, subtopic, a chapter I'm writing or a certain event, and cluster them that way rather than dividing them one and the other.
So where in your research process do you like to start writing? Do you start writing from the beginning?
I do start writing from the beginning. I think that part of this is psychological. A blank Word doc, a blank document is very daunting. I encourage all my graduate students to do the same thing. Just start writing stuff. The stuff you write early is not going to be the stuff that often it's the things that get thrown away. But then you get comfortable with also the process of killing your darlings, which I think is really important. And also kind of being more select, figuring out what goes in and what stays out, that you don't have to write up every single source. But I think getting in the habit of writing and having running documents and having drafts, and even if they're just squibs and incomplete bits, you know, getting words on paper and trying to make that a regular habit. I don't want to say a daily habit because I would, you know, even I don't make it a daily habit, even though I aspire to. But I think the more you can just spend time writing things, the stronger that muscle is. And also the less daunting it becomes to embark on, particularly a long form writing project like a book.
How do you transition from those sorts of like little bits of writing then to completing a full draft?
I will combine documents. I do a lot of cut pasting. I always, and this is my kind of security blanket strategy, when I'm cutting anything, I throw it in another Word doc, kind of Eclipse document. Usually it is a dustbin to which I never return, but somehow knowing I'm saving those words makes me feel better and it's easier to cut them. But I do spend a lot of time playing around with structure when I have some things on the page. I will certainly have outlines. That's actually one thing that I use those yellow pads for. It's very useful to do outlines and kind of reiterate on those. I'm a big fan of post-it notes on the wall. Like, here are the things I want to write about, and just making a note of that and then putting it on the wall. When I'm deep into book work, then it definitely is a bit of a, you know, so-called wall of crazy. Like, there's a lot of things up there. But that is useful. I have a big whiteboard in my office that I use to put down, you know, things that I try to kind of figure out relationships between different things and people. That being said, I am a chronological person. It's interesting. I've played around in a couple of instances, both with not less so with books, but more with other writing, and kind of not moving chronologically, moving thematically. And my brain really rebels against it. I have a harder time with narrative structure when it's not, you know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. I like names and dates. I like that chronology. And so having timelines, I always find very useful. And I love the synergy of this person was doing this thing, and then halfway around the world, this other person was doing this thing, and thinking about how, you know, at the same moment, these seemingly unrelated things were happening, and helping to put whatever your main action is in broader context.
What then does your revision process look like?
My revision process is pretty comprehensive, but I will say my writing process is pretty intense too. And I say this with, I wish it were otherwise. I wish I were better at the bad first draft, just being comfortable with kind of getting words on the page. I certainly will do that in other just as the writing discipline, I'll kind of make sure I'm putting words on the page in some way. But somehow when I'm writing something, I tend to polish every stone a bit. That being said, I still revise a lot. So I've come to realize that this is the way I write. It works. It's more painful, or it feels more painful than just, I'm just going to put everything out there and not really care about how pretty it is. But I think it's really important as a writer to kind of acknowledge, like, this is the way my brain works, my neurons fire. This is how it works for me, rather than feeling like, ah, darn it, why aren't I doing it this way? This other person seems to do it so effectively, or why can't I, go faster? There's always, I think historians in particular, we're always berating ourselves for not going faster. And certainly having, you know, worked in, with journalists and the very, very fast pace of newspaper and magazine journalism relative to history, that kind of makes you feel even more self-conscious about, I just go as I go and I try to get it done as quickly as I can. But sometimes it just doesn't come as quickly, because what we do is quite complex and does require a lot of thought about content and structure, as well as argument.
You said, though, that your revision process is comprehensive. So what, as you edit your drafts as you go, mm-hmm. do you then yeah. step back and take a big picture edit?
I do. I will do a big picture edit. I will come back to something. And I don't, I don't completely tear everything up and start again. But as particularly when you're working long form, when you're looking at book chapters and sections and structure, just going in and then just giving it a rest. The other wonderful thing about writing a draft or a second draft or something that's still in progress, and then going away from it for a while and returning to it, you feel so much more charitable about it. It's so much better than you thought, right? So when you've been when I just come off writing something, I'm like, oh, I guess this is good enough, you know, sending it off, or I'm going to let it be. And then I come back, I'm like, oh, no, that's really good. Oh, yeah. And I even to this day will find big chunks of the code that didn't make it in the code for narrative reasons. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty good. I should do something with that. So that's we are very hard on ourselves. and it's really valuable to go away from it and give yourself, you know, some rest. It's kind of like, you know, exercise or strength training or anything intense. You just have to give yourself a break and then come back, and it's, you see things in a different light. And you also can see the flaws more clearly. You're like, oh, wait a minute, what am I talking about there? Well, maybe, what if I just switch the order of these paragraphs? Oh, that's so much better. So we you know, can't just grind and expect to have a clear sense of what's possible for your manuscript.
Speaking of giving yourself a break, I was struck while I was preparing for this interview that you have so much going on, both professionally and personally. You know, you have a family and a life. Uh-huh. How do you keep writing from getting lost in the shuffle of all of that?
It's not like, yes, it does occasionally get lost in the shuffle. You know, I think, again, this is, you know, part of these are the, you know, the mind tricks that we play on ourselves, both positive and negative. I think part of it is understanding that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and that life has a rhythm. There are times when personal things take precedence, and there are times when there's more room for professional things, including writing. I think it's really important. You know, I was working on, my kids are teenagers now, so they're more self-sufficient. But when my kids were really little, I would feel very self-indulgent to be hiring a babysitter or caregiver to go sit in a coffee shop for an afternoon and try and work on something and maybe leave with like a couple hundred of decent words and that was it. That's a really difficult thing, I think, for caregivers, parents, and others to do when others depend on you. I think this also counts for, it's a lot easy to kind of let teaching and other professional obligations that other people are essentially asking you to do to take up the space and not feel bad about it. And so writing becomes this sort of, you know, selfish act, but it's not. It's actually fundamental to what we do, and it's fundamental to what we give. And so, you know, I think we all, forgiving myself for imperfections, trying to get the plate as less full, or making sure that whatever is on the plate are things that are things in which I am invested and I believe are important for me to do. Sometimes those are things that other people want me to do, and I agree that they should be a priority. And other times they are things that I want to do, and I have to assert that that's what I want to do. And that, you know, saying no and sharpening that ability to say no and not be too helpful to everyone sometimes has to be what one has to do. But it's not, you know, it's never entirely smooth. I mean, no, I don't think anybody has it fully figured out. We're all kind of spinning the plates and it's like, oh, one might fall at any time. But I you know, as time has gone on, and look, I sit from a, I am deeply aware of how lucky I am. I am a, you know, senior tenured professor at a research university. And I do have, you know, I do have the ability to say no to things in a way that I didn't at earlier points in my career. But, you know, appreciating that, you know, even at any point in my career, when I look back to when I was on the tenure track, or even before when I wasn't on the tenure track and was trying to get on it, there were things I was saying yes to that, like, looking back, I'm like, I didn't really have to put myself through that. That, you know, that did not help me, nor did it help the people I was supposed to be helping. So it's good to remind ourselves that we're not, you know, indispensable. We don't have to be indispensable to everyone all the time.
Absolutely. Well, I want to ask about you. You have written about, or you do write about, and specialize in history in very different areas, particularly tech history and then presidential history, although there are definitely connections between them too. But, you know, I'm curious both, why are you drawn to those two different subjects? And then how do you keep that balance between them?
I'm interested in power. And I think that really the, you know, I call my time working in Washington, D.C. in the Clinton administration, both in the White House and I was at Health and Human Services, as my first graduate school, because so much of what I observed there, experienced there, really colors what I pursue now. I already talked about the writing discipline. I think there is that, you know, the core, the talking points in the briefing book, and are still there in my soul. Although part of the reason I went to graduate school, I was like, I would like to write something in my own voice, please. I do not want to write in Al Gore's voice anymore. I know he's the vice president, but I need to move on. And, you know, again, it was like, what an extraordinary experience to have in your early 20s. But still, it was, you know, I'm really glad I had that time in my life and I'm glad I moved on from it. But what I did observe there is I was in the room where it happened occasionally, on the periphery of the room, to be clear, like against the wall as the support staff. I was, you know, not making any decisions, but really observing up close how the most powerful people in the world were just human beings trying to muddle their way through. And that there was no heroes, no villains, that these are complex beings. There's, you know, historical contingency at work. The other thing that was really interesting and why I chose history graduate school as opposed to law school or public policy school was there was not a lot of historical thinking going on in the room where it happened, that everyone was barreling forward from the present tense to the future tense, occasionally calling in historians to, you know, sit and talk to the president about what would Lincoln do in the situation. But kind of at the moment, there was not a sense of, okay, you know, 40 years ago, we did this, and this is how it played out. Maybe this legislation should, you know, we should keep that in mind as we craft this new piece of legislation, because there just really isn't time and bandwidth to appreciate it and understand it. And so that was my, you know, kind of what drove me to grad school. I went to grad school to study politics. I actually had worked on social policy and anti-poverty programs. And so I went to graduate school to study that, the history of that. And I came out of graduate school studying very, very wealthy people in Silicon Valley, which, of course, it's all the same political economy. So it wasn't that much of a difference, but it still was, you know, how power works, who the haves and the have-nots are. And I'm very interested, I think, both in the case of presidents, modern presidents, and then certainly 21st century Silicon Valley. You have some similar phenomena happening where there's extraordinary concentration of power. There is a bubble surrounding the people at the center of it. It is very, very hard to keep a bead on reality and how most people are living their lives when you're either a U.S. modern U.S. president or a tech billionaire. It depends, in the case of the presidents, having people around you, you know, hiring good people and having people who will say no to you and give you good advice, and having a kind of moral compass that will help guide you. And I think the same thing goes for, you know, the titans of tech today are even more interesting in that they, you know, at least someone who becomes president, well, most of them, kind of, that was a lifelong project, right? Bill Clinton was thinking about being president at a very young age and worked towards that and had a long career in government. Even someone like Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, considered to be terribly inexperienced when he was elected, had been governor of California for two terms. Like, it was not nothing. Whereas, you know, we look at some of the people who are the most powerful people in the tech world today, and they are very young people, as young men who had really done very little other than just software engineering and coding, suddenly come into immense success and wealth and don't have a broader sense of the world and may not always have people around them who are willing to speak truth to power. So, you know, they have to build that education while they're actually flying the airplane. And there's a, you know, I just find all that very, very interesting. I see a lot of parallels. And also the two worlds are very closely connected. I had the, you know, I came to Silicon Valley in part because Silicon Valley was a place that I, certainly when I started writing about it in the late 90s, they were in denial that the government had anything to do with them ever. And of course, that was like catnip to me. I'm like, aha, I shall show you. And so that's how my dissertation project took shape that became my first book, Cities of Knowledge.
We've talked about how your first job really influenced your writing. You also write a lot in sort of public forums, whether that's op-eds or essays. How has that type of writing shaped your approach?
A number of ways. I feel so fortunate to have had the opportunity to publish in these public forums and also to be edited by extraordinary editors. I've learned so much. that's the secret to good op-eds is a good editor. that's the secret. People are like, oh, how does this? That was a great piece. How did you do that? I'm like, oh, I had a great editor. It was useful. You know, one of the things I realized soon after I started doing more public writing is I had sort of prided myself on being like, oh, I have this background in politics, you know, talking points, speech writing. I'm a, you know, clear, crisp. I'm not getting sunk down in academic writing, you know, the problems that some academics have and kind of rising above and telling a story. Oh, no, I felt very fuddy-duddy when I was first, you know, sending in pitches and drafts, and they're like, no, you're not getting to the point. Like, what's your lead? Be more crisp. And I think that it was a reminder of the importance of simplicity and how quickly you do have to get to the point and be very clear about this is what my hook is, this is what my point is. And to be learning how to be very economical in writing about complex things, but yet not giving up the complexity. That was something too that I really tried to do with the code, is to be kind of reader friendly to people who were maybe tech users, but not technologists themselves, but also not to do away with all of the complexity that was kind of communicate that this was not something that was just, you know, one and done. So I've learned from, you know, I've learned how to write. Of course, writing short is much harder than writing long. And so it's been a good reminder of being very economical with words. The other thing that writing for the public really built my muscle for is, you know, certainly when I was writing pretty often for the New York Times, I was being asked to write about things that were not my, you know, I hadn't written a book about, or more pointedly, someone else had written books about. And my initial instinct is like, oh, no, that's not my area of specialty. You should, you know, you kind of defer to other historians, rightly, who've done the work. And so this counts for public writing. This is not for academic writing. But when one is writing for the public as a historian, and you're kind of the only historian in the room, what I tried to do was first have the confidence to say, well, look, I teach about the tariff, 19th century tariff. I can write about it like I teach about it. And as when I teach about it, I'm going to draw upon the work, the extraordinary work that others have done, and I'm going to give them credit. So what I really sought to do, of course, you can't footnote an op-ed, but I really, really tried to really mindfully draw on the other scholarship to quote from other scholars, not in a way that was clunky and kind of would send a regular op-ed page reader sort of to scurry to this, you know, another section of the paper. But something that made it clear that, you know, there is a body of work about this. And what I also tried to do after a column came out, this is when Twitter was still Twitter and not X, I would go on Twitter and do a thread that had links to all of the work that I drew upon to, you know, I wrote a column on presidents paying their taxes, on presidential tax returns. That was a wild ride, which was really fun. But, you know, that was an example of something where, you know, I knew enough, you know, to write something coherent, but I was really digging in deep and doing a lot of research and drawing upon the work of other historians and other scholars of taxation.
To talk about how so many things come together in Margaret's writing, I asked her to read an excerpt from The Code and talk to me a bit about it. Here's Dr. Margaret O'Meara reading from The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America.
The morning fog hadn't yet burned off the plum orchards as the rented blue Pontiac rumbled down the country road a few miles south of Palo Alto. Bill Draper was behind the wheel. His friend and business partner, Pitch Johnson, was doing the same thing in another orchard, in an identical blue Pontiac. They did this every morning in those heady, early days of Kennedy's New Frontier. Wake up early, hop in the rental cars, go on the hunt for deals. Draper slowed down as he spotted a wooden barn looming up among the trees. A farmer had built it years before to dry the harvest, but as he got closer, Draper could tell it wasn't full of prunes any longer. Nailed up over the door was a sign with a company name on it, syllables of Tex and Trons, that signaled a fledgling electronics operation inside. Rolling to a stop, Draper hopped out of the Pontiac and headed to the door. A brisk knock, the door opened. Another young man, in shirt sleeves, squinted out into the morning light. Draper introduced himself and got right to the point.
I'm a venture capitalist. We buy minority interest in companies like yours and turn over money to you to grow your business. That was all a cash-poor entrepreneur needed to hear. Come on in, the young man replied. Draper had just snagged another one. Morning after morning, company after company, Bill Draper and Pitch Johnson became the go-to guys if you were a young and hungry electronics company.
I had such a hard time choosing what passage to pull. So it's such a good book. What goes into writing a passage like this?
You know, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking about when I first heard this story. I was sitting at lunch at the retirement community, a very high-end retirement community that's just across the street from the Stanford Shopping Center on Sand Hill Road on the border of Palo Alto and Menlo Park, talking to Bill Draper, who in his mid-80s at the time was still very vigorous, had just come from a game of tennis. And him telling the story, which I know he had told to other people many times before, and then he again told it to me again. Pitch Johnson told it to me again. It's the story they tell about themselves. But I love how, and we were eating club sandwiches and talking about it. And, you know, during those lunches, and this is one of the reasons that the venture capitalists became, you know, big figures in the book, because they are this connective tissue across the generations. I realized that, you know, a couple of things about these people. First of all, they've been friends eating club sandwiches together for lunch and playing tennis since the 50s. They're very close. And how I got to interview so many of these people is because they all knew each other. I talked to one, they're like, oh, you need to talk to my friend so-and-so. and they're retired. So they had nothing but time and they were still very with it and energetic. And, you know, it was great. But, you know, this sense of possibility and beginnings and kind of wide openness and they talked about, you know, they'd always bring up the blue Pontiac. They had these matching cars. And what I really loved about the story, what I wanted to do was situate the reader in a Silicon Valley that was before it was Silicon Valley, when it was really not a place that was, you know, anyone at the time would have thought destined to be the high-tech capital of the world. Like, this was an agricultural valley in California. And Draper and Johnson and others like them were young guys. They were not particularly rich and famous or even particularly techie. Draper came from, he had a pedigree. He went to Yale. He had an Ivy'd background. He was the exception. Almost all of the people in this generation, and certainly the ones starting companies, were out in California because they didn't have connections. They were scholarship kids. They were all white men, to be clear. But in the world of mid-20th century America, they were suddenly given this opportunity because of their engineering interests and skills and because of Cold War spending that was causing the electronics industry to boom, to become entrepreneurs and in some cases become spectacularly successful. So these very, very rich men that I had club sandwiches with in the middle of the 20 teens were, you know, started off their careers as poor boys working on the oil rigs in Texas for the summer to pay for their college expense, for their books for college, or, you know, from small towns in Iowa, or small towns in South Carolina. They were not people that were expected to be titans of industry. And I thought that was a really revealing thing about, you know, helping to show how mid-century America, mid-20th century, that era of prosperity and of public spending created this escalator of opportunity for so many people.
When you're interviewing people for a book like you were here, are you also looking for details as a writer that you can include for scenes? So I know that they brought up the blue Pontiac, but yeah. You know, do you ask, like, what was the day like that day? You know, what were you wearing? What were you thinking? That sort of thing.
That is actually most of what I'm looking for when I interview people. And that's something I learned through the process of doing this book. I started off being like, oh, you're going to tell me things. And look, human memory is fallible. It's actually something that really came home to me when I was writing my second book, Pivotal Tuesdays, which is about presidential elections, including the election of 92, which I worked on. And I was like, this is going to be a breeze. I remember everything. Oh, heck no. I forgot like 2/3 of it. So, you know, oral history is an extraordinarily valuable source, particularly when conducted by a trained oral historian, which I am not. But it, you know, you are relying on someone in, you know, it's the cases of the people I was talking to, you're relying on people to remember details from many decades prior, and also details that have been burnished and may have altered over many decades of talking about them and remembering them, right? So the things that I really appreciated and I loved about talking to these people in the, you know, most of whom were toward the end of their lives were the personality details I could pick up and the things about them. So, for example, one of the venture capitalists I spoke with, who I was talking about lobbying for lower taxes, and he's like, oh, you know what? Next time we meet, I'm going to bring you a copy of my calendar from 1976. And I'll show you so you can keep track of all the people I met with on Capitol Hill. So A, he still had the calendar. B, when he brought me the copies, it was a color copy because he had color blocked and coded everything so neatly and tidily. And I thought that was just a wonderful detail about him. And he, you know, so I think that's the value of having these conversations, not to expect, oh, I'm going to discover something factual that an archive won't show me or another kind of archive won't show me. Maybe you will, maybe something will slip out. But I came to appreciate them more by I could write about them. I could bring them to life on the page after I talked to them in a way that I could not had I not had these conversations.
That's fantastic. Your writing is so clear, such a delight to read. I know from experience that making writing look so easy is often actually really hard work. At this point, does it come fairly naturally to you to write so clearly, or does that get pared down in the revision process?
It does not come to me easily. I don't know if that makes listeners feel better or worse. No, it does not. It doesn't get easier. I wish it would. Don't we all? I wish it were easier. You know, sometimes you're like, why did I choose to do this for a living? Like, what? It doesn't. But there is something that is exciting about the process. You know, when you get in the flow of it, that you can't replicate in any other way. It is gorgeous. And of course, nothing's better than, you know, closing the computer and being like, oh, I wrote some good words today. You know, it doesn't get easier. I think that what has gotten easier is I do kind of start with the people. I mean, I have an argument, I have ideas, but when I'm thinking about actually writing the thing, I'm like, okay, what are the stories that can carry my ideas? Who are the people that can carry my ideas? And so in a way that's shifting a bit to thinking more journalistically or novelistically than a lot of academic writing, right? That isn't mutually exclusive. I think there's sort of actually more historians than not who write kind of narrative. We're all storytellers. And the kind of, you know, old chestnut of like clunky historical writing. I honestly don't know where that exists anymore. I think there's just brilliant, brilliant stuff being written. If it ever really existed, I think it's a bit, yes, there can be really complex ideas that can be hard to, you've got to think hard to grapple with them, but that doesn't mean it's hard to read. So I do think about who are my people. And I think a lot, and this is something that my students, my graduate students and my undergraduates, I think get tired of me, you know, my comments on drafts when there's, you know, I never like it when an acronym is doing the action, right? When it's like an agency, when there's something like, oh, HHS, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, who in HHS? What people? This is human choices. Like the building, you know, the White House didn't do it. The, you know, other people did it. You know, Facebook didn't do it. Who did it? So that, you know, who are the human beings? And I think making myself, forcing that discipline on myself too, and being really, really trying to dig down into who did what, when, where, how, which is what historians, that's part of what we bring to the party, right? We make it clear that these are human choices and that there is agency here. And that's not just these, nothing's inevitable. There are no monoliths, no acronyms do things.
I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the code. You mentioned earlier that you're definitely a chronological person, and the book is largely chronological, but you've structured it in four acts. But then there are these series of what you've called arrivals, where you sort of introduce characters. How did you settle on this structure for the book?
Well, I was, you know, part of it was whenever you're writing a book, you're, you know, reading a lot of other books and thinking about how structure, you know, is effective. And I really found myself drawn to structures, books that sort of where you do take that beat in between parts, where you have these short interludes. One book that kind of very directly influenced my thinking as I was thinking about the structure was Richard White's Railroaded, which is about the Transcontinentals. And he has these wonderful interludes that are, you know, not necessarily, they sort of take you out of the narrative, but give you something that is related to the narrative and kind of set you up. As I thought about the structure, I knew from the start that I wanted to have kind of delineate that there have been several different, there have been multiple Silicon Valleys. There's still, you know, there are many existing today, but there's sort of been different eras that are pretty distinct. And I thought that it would be also kind of fun to make them analogous to the process of launching a startup or a new product. And which is kind of, you know, thinking about Silicon Valley, the place, as like analogous to a company, as is sort of, that was a bit of a, you know, a bit of shtick, but also it was trying to make my point about the long evolution. Like, we would not have gotten to now if we hadn't had the then, that these things are connected. It isn't just, this is a nice historical plaque and we've moved on. And that's definitely the way that a lot of technologists, not all, but many, think about history. They're like, oh, that's not relevant to what I'm doing. I'm building the future. I wanted to make the human bit. The other thing I really wanted to do with this book, because so much of, you know, it's so easy to, again, write about, just like we don't want acronyms doing the action, it's so easy to write about technology and talk about technology as if it's doing it on its own. Like, we just think about how the public discussion about artificial intelligence goes, right? AI this, AI that. Well, an AI is a thing built by people and controlled by people. And you know, it has humanity. And that was part of my, you know, what I wanted to do with this book, was to show the human beings and the range of human beings, not just software engineers, not just electrical engineers or hardware makers, but people from a range of backgrounds, a demographic diversity I wanted to illustrate. And also to kind of, you know, it's fun going into people's lives and bringing, you know, kind of, there's some really great personalities. And they aren't just, and it's a range of personalities. It isn't just like a wacky tech guy. Like, there are also stereotypes that, you know, I wanted to transcend and I wanted to play with.
For all historians, but I have to imagine maybe especially for someone writing about subjects that are so influencing our lives still right now. Although, what history does that not apply to?
Yes.
I don't know. But there, you know, one of the struggles is to make sure that we're not making history seem like something inevitable, like the way things are today was how it would always go. We talk about historical contingency. Do you have a strategy as you're writing for making sure that both you and the reader are kind of back in that place of possibility rather than feeling like you're just foreshadowing what we already know is coming?
I do. I, you know, while I think ultimately in the final draft of the code, my organizational structure was very much, you know, when I went in those final revisions, I was like, how is what I'm talking about helping us understand how we get to now, how we get to the now of big tech and platforms? And, but also to be very clear, and I think this is the, you know, what this book sought to do was to place this funny place out this, you know, about in California where those wacky tech guys, place it in broader historical context, in political history, nestle it in social history. This is a history of America. This is a modern American history from the 1940s to the present. And tech is part of that and is a product of that and a shaper of that, the tech industry is. So what I sought to do, for example, in talking about the, you know, the years right before the Second World War, when companies like Hewlett-Packard and other Stanford spinoffs are starting up in garages in Palo Alto. What I also mention in that discussion is there were guys in garages all over the United States in this kind of the beginning of the 20th century. This was tinkerers in garages were a thing. So you could go to Dayton, Ohio. You could go to a lot of places where you could find much more, many, many more of them, to be clear, you know, Wright Brothers in Dayton, for example. But go to any community, town, city of any significance, any region of the country, and you would find some garage startups, a few handful here and there, because that handful of garage startups near Stanford included Hewlett-Packard and other companies that became extraordinarily successful and was the kind of the germ of what came next. It's, you know, that doesn't mean that this was destined. Now, at the same time, there were other things in place earlier that did, even before the Second World War, which was very much a hinge of history and was a propulsive force in making Silicon Valley an electronics center. But, you know, there were other things there in that region of the country. There were there was a specialization in small electronics and communication devices, which kind of makes sense in the Bay Area because you're far away and needing to do long distance communication, including communication at sea. So remote communication was a priority. It was of an interest. So no surprise that there is a regional specialization in that. And then what turns out to happen is, again, this is not inevitable, but the electronics industry, as it grows in Silicon Valley before it was Silicon Valley in the 50s and 60s, mostly defense oriented and space oriented, is small electronics and communication devices. Well, those are the building blocks for the technology, consumer technology world that we have today, right? The computer industry, though, which obviously is important to the story, but that was all on the East Coast. Like, all those companies were headquartered in the Northeast. So, you know, I think showing that geographic variety. Also, I really wanted to talk a lot about Boston as a kind of the symbiotic relationship between Silicon Valley and Boston, not a competitive one. Silicon Valley was too small and too insignificant with it for a while. But, you know, that also, and putting it in context, I think helps with that to show readers that nothing was inevitable. And that's really exciting, right? That's the fun part when you're like, no, this was not destined to be. And that also puts agency back in, human agency, human choice, and the choices that were made on the ground by people there to not only just have history happen to them, but also to try to bend the arc really made a difference.
Are there people you rely on for feedback as you are writing?
Yes, I am. My husband is a big truth teller. He's not an academic, which is been tremendously helpful. His bullshit detector is very, very finely tuned. And that has been extremely, extremely helpful in both talking through ideas and having him give feedback on drafts to the degree that he can be patient. He patiently will do it. sometimes I try not to put too much on him. But I think even just having, you know, conversations, the sort of talking through ideas is really, really generative. I also I get really good feedback both from, you know, from colleagues, like workshopping as early and often as you can, even when it's scary, is very, very helpful. Sometimes you come with too many ideas, but it also is helpful in saying, no, this is what I'm saying. So sometimes when someone is giving you advice that you actually don't think is right for the project, or then you're like, no. Okay, clearly I'm not making clear what my point is. So I'm not, you know, there's something about if I'm getting advice that I think is off base, let me pause a bit and say, well, maybe this is something about the current draft or the current conceptualization of the project that I need to more fully flesh out and be more clear in writing about, or even just think about more hard. so that's really useful. And then, you know, editorial feedback, both stylistic and content wise at the later stages, you know, the more eyes upon it, you don't want too many eyes, too many cooks. But one of the things I did for my first book manuscript is that was extremely valuable is I actually did a second round of, there was obviously peer review. It was published with Princeton. But I had another set of mentors who were gracious enough to read the book too and give me feedback. And they came from the diversity of their disciplinary specialties was such that it really, really was very generative because they were asking different questions and pointing out different things. And they were all, and I think having other people whose writing you admire read your writing and not be defensive about it and be brave enough to do it. Sometimes it can be really scary. That can be so, so helpful.
Are there other people, speaking of people whose writing you admire, but are there other people whose work you like to read as inspiration as a writer, or maybe even other media that you look to?
Oh gosh, I read widely and deeply, and I'm just so excited by all of the There's such a flood of books that have come out even in the last 3 or 4 years. I can't even name them all. But I, you know, I think one of the things that's happened in with historians, with history books and books by historians, both those working in academia and those out, is there have been more and more kind of the academic trade hybrid books published by academic presses that are written with a broader audience in mind, and in some cases marketed very effectively to those broader audiences. And vice versa, you have trade houses that are really supportive of and putting out books that are narratively compelling, but also are really important works of scholarship. One of the things, the sort of the great, you know, it was such a pleasure to work with Penguin Press for The Code. And one of the things that, you know, in addition to all the kind of fantastic editorial support I got, and it sort of made it such a, the book that it is, but also, you know, being able to, you know, those footnotes are dense. There are no, you know, no footnote was stripped down for this. This was I got to really show my work and leave a lot of breadcrumbs for other scholars and others to pick up on. There's a lot of stories in the book that I give a couple paragraphs to that could be books in themselves. And that's really what I tried to do. So, you know, there are a lot, and I read fiction. You know, I'm always have something, a work of fiction going on. I wish I read more. I go on these big jags when I'm on vacation, and I'll just tear through lots and lots and lots and lots of books, and then there'll be a dry spell. But there's, I think the more that one reads, the more you absorb. And I read very carefully and with great admiration historians writing in the public. It's very exciting to see historians like Jill Lepore and now Daniel Immerwahr and others in The New Yorker and seeing historians who are writing long form work in magazines like The Atlantic and The New Republic and other. Those are things that I read avidly and carefully and with cheering along. Because I think one of the things when I first started grad school back in 1997 after working in Washington, as I was introduced to all this sort of extraordinary literature and coming at it from my kind of public policy wonk head, I'm like, oh, I feel like there's just all these wonderful lights are under bushels. You know, they're being published in academic journals. They're being published by university presses, and they're hot topics of conversation within academia and in graduate seminars. And they're not out in the public. And you didn't have as many historians writing for the public. And, you know, this is what I call the silver lining of the very, very dark cloud of the collapse of the job market is, and also the proliferation of online outlets, is you have so many more historians who are writing for public audiences. And I think that is just a net good. Now, we just got to make it, you know, economically feasible. We need to find a way to make that people make a good living doing that. But I think that's so different from 2024, is so very, very different from the late 90s in terms of the kind of public intellectual, you know, historians as public intellectuals and how many of us there are. And there isn't kind of, you don't have to choose a lane, which I certainly felt at the beginning of my academic career, I had to kind of choose a lane and maybe downplay the public work I was doing and the more applied public policy related things I was doing. I didn't really trumpet them on my CV, and now I see them all as of a piece. I write an op-ed, it relates to my teaching, it relates to my research, and vice versa. All these things are generative.
What's the best piece of writing advice you've ever gotten?
There have been a number of pieces of writing advice. There has been, strangely, one of the best pieces of writing advice was from my graduate advisor, the late Michael B. Katz, who was just extraordinary and taught me how to be a great advisor. Incredible, incredible human being. But when I would finish my comprehensive exams, I announced to him that I was moving to San Francisco from Philadelphia. I was at Penn, and to work on my dissertation there. At that time, my dissertation was not necessarily California centric. I was moving there because my husband had just was taking a job at a dot-com company. And he, knowing, and this was like a Jedi mind trick that I admire in retrospect greatly, he kind of gave me this long, he gave this long sigh, and he's like, you know, when graduate students move across the country to when they're writing their dissertation, they rarely finish it. And so that was like, he knew exactly what he was doing. I'm like, darn it, I'm going to finish this and I'm going to prove him wrong. He knew exactly. So sometimes that was very helpful. But I think in terms of kind of writing advice, concrete writing advice, I think, you know, write what you, some of the aphorisms are kind of, you know, the hackneyed ones are sort of true. Write what you know. I was working on a kind of grand comparative project on high-tech regions around the world and flailing a bit. And my then literary agent, Jerry Toma, was like, write what you know, write about Silicon Valley. I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I know. Okay. And then I also got a wonderful piece of advice when I was in the early stages of the code and sort of thinking about it in a way, kind of writing around the big story, feeling like this isn't, you know, I'm not the one to write the comprehensive history of Silicon Valley. Like someone else is going to do that. Some journalist is going to do it. And my friend Fred Turner, who's at Stanford, he and I were on a fellowship together, and we were sitting down having coffee, and I was sort of like, oh, I just don't know what I can. He's like, just write the whole thing. You write the thing. You're supposed to write it. I'm like, you're right. I am supposed to write it. Yeah. Like I can't like wait around for someone else to write it. I'm going to write it. And so these are, you know, these are less sort of about the process of writing. I mean, there are other things like, you know, just put your butt in the seat and, you know, like turn off the internet and all the things we know we should do. But the other, I guess the last, I think the one operational piece of writing that I should also mention that has been very valuable to me. And I think it's, I feel like it, he didn't say it quite this way, but I think the idea really came to me from feedback I got from Richard White on the manuscript for my first book. And essentially it's sort of a version of the Joyce Carol Oates, you know, you can't write the first line of the projects until you've written the last line. And it's the advice I give all my graduate students and undergraduates and myself, which is write the introduction or revise the introduction last. Because it's when you get to the very end, you realize this is really what I need to say. And I need to say it early and punchily. I need to sort of put that out there as quickly as possible. And so the first line usually comes after the last line. So the first line is the last thing I write.
Well, speaking of, I know you're on sabbatical now and working on another book project. Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on?
Yeah, I'm in the... depending on the day, I would say I'm in the happy playing in the sandbox, or, you know, that's on the good days. And the other days I'm wading through the fire swamps and might sink at any minute, which is the, you know, early stages of research and exploration and thinking about a book that's I'm thinking of as a history of extreme wealth in America from the 19th century to the present. And the kind of inspiration of it comes from, in a way that, well, these are questions that I've been asked repeatedly over the last several years since the code came out, from a variety of sources, you know, students, journalists, colleagues, interested members of the public, that are essentially some version of, so what does Jeff Bezos have in common with John D. Rockefeller? Or how are Andrew Carnegie and Bill Gates alike or different? Is this a second Gilded Age, or how does our second Gilded Age compare with the first? So I'm playing around with that. I'm not entirely sure what it's going to look like. I would like it to be not a weighty tome for my own sanity, and also just for the reader. I would like this to be something that helps people understand and contextualize properly the, you know, extreme wealth creation and the American billionaire in historical context. So a lot of it is TBD, but what I'm doing, you know, one of the things in the stage of this project, and this is partially, you know, this will be my fourth book. So I'm fortunate in that I don't feel like got to get it done to get tenure, got to get it done to get something. You know, I have latitude. Again, as I said at the top, it's like a great blessing and also a great curse because I don't have a deadline yet. It's just all self-imposed. But I really am trying to give myself lots of time. I'm having some really great conversations and kind of giving it oxygen and talking to people. So anyone listening, if you would like to, I'd be delighted to hear your thoughts about the idea. That has been, I think that's a luxury I have right now in my career. And also one of the things I wanted to do, and I've gone and given workshops at other universities and my university about this book, essentially the kind of proposal as it stands now and kind of the early ideas I have for it, is trying to model this, you know, essentially, particularly for graduate students and scholars earlier in their careers, kind of the stop and start, the messy process of book creation. It's very easy to come and give a presentation on something that you've already done and it's all, you know, sharpened and it's gotten all its feedback and it's all nice and tied up with a bow. It's a little more, you know, can be humbling, but also very, very intellectually rewarding it in having conversations that are more open-ended and saying, I have this idea. I know it's only not even half baked, maybe a quarter baked. It's a little warm. What do you think? And what would you have, you know, what ideas might you have? What are your reactions to it? And that's just been, that's been great. And so I'm having a lot of fun with that. And I'm writing some shorter form things that are playing around with different elements of it. I'm also, quite frankly, I'm also getting pulled into the maw of AI mania. So I will be writing some things about that and trying to contextualize that and giving, you know, speeches about that type of thing. So there are other things that are other strands I'm chasing. I'm letting this do a slow burn and not so, you know, don't ask me when it will appear in print, but it's been really interesting and it's been really, really fun and so rewarding to go deep into the 19th century again, where, you know, I'm a 20th century, 21st century historian. So it's been really great to just marinate in that literature and think about that strange foreign country that is the past.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Margaret O'Meara, thank you so much. It's been such a joy to talk with you about your writing process on Drafting the Past.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you again to Dr. Margaret O'Meara for that excellent conversation. And thank you for listening. You can find links to all of the books we talked about, as well as a transcript of the episode at draftingthepast.com. A quick programming note. I am reluctantly taking a break from the podcast for April and May while I focus on getting my dissertation finished. Don't worry, though, Drafting the Past isn't going anywhere, and I will be back in June with some wonderful interviews that are already lined up and ready for you. Thanks for your patience. In the meantime, check out some of the back episodes you might have missed or want to revisit. And remember that friends don't let friends write boring history.